BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Krupa Party, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast.
Hello, and thank you for being with us. It was around this time yesterday during our programme that we learnt that Donald Trump had won the US presidential election for a second time. And over the past 24 hours, there's been a lot of soul searching from Democrats and, of course, celebrations from Republican supporters. It was dubbed the gender election, where the difference in the way men and women vote would decide the result. But abortion turned out not to be the defining factor for women's votes. We're going to discuss what did. We will hear from Women's Hour's own Nuala McGovern, who is in Washington for us, and we'll be looking at how the new government's policies might impact women in the coming months and years. We will also talk about one woman's quest to wear football joggers. You might have seen last week that Iqra Ismail was barred from playing in a match for refusing to wear shorts due to her religious beliefs. Her experience coming up. And we're going to talk about dating red flags, and in particular, red flag questions. This is after the pop star Olivia Rodrigo said during an interview on Netflix that she had a red flag question when on dates. She said, "I always ask them if they would go to space. If they say yes, I don't date them. I just think if you want to go to space, you're a little too full of yourself." Well, what are your red flag questions on dates, no matter how big or small? What is the question you must ask? And what about the questions that you've been asked on dates that have made you think twice about the date that you're on? Do share your stories with us by texting the programme. That number is 84844. Over on social media, that's Instagram and X. We are at BBC Women's Hour. And of course, you can email us through our website, or you can now send us a WhatsApp audio message using the number 03700 100 444. All of our terms and conditions can be found over on our website. Plus, we speak to the artist Sophie T, whose work capturing the female form has earned her over 1 million followers on TikTok. So let's start with the US election outcome dominating front pages around the world as people ask that question, what does a second Trump presidency mean for them? And we are doing exactly the same, asking what does it mean for women? We spoke to Nuala live from Washington yesterday after a mammoth night of broadcasting for her covering the elections. And she's back with us again today. Hello, Nuala.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well rested, I hope.
Not feeling too bad, actually.
Well, yesterday when we spoke, you said you had one key question. You wanted to know more about how women voted. That was your mission, to find out why. Are we any clearer to understanding that?
Yeah, they're beginning to have quite a lot of exit polls. So taking a look at how people voted and breaking it down. And there was some this morning that I was taking a look at, which I thought we might find interesting to have a look at. If we take a look at Harris, for men, it was 42%. For Trump, 55%. For women, 53% for Harris, 45% for Trump. But that is overall and with the United States. But when you begin to break it down, then you see different figures emerge. For example, white women, Trump had a majority there. If we talk about black women instead, it was 9 out of 10 voted for Harris. We did see, as we expected, a breakdown when it came to college educated, non-college educated, 63% for Trump. This is women, 35% for Harris. And women with a college education, 57% for Harris, 41% for Trump. But a lot of people, I think the white woman is the part that people are drilling down into, because they did what they did in 2016, which was go in larger numbers for Trump than the Democrat. And I think some people thought with the issue of abortion that this time it might be different, but it appears not. I was just having a look at the most important issue in this vote, and this is overall men and women. But it was the economy that people voted for Trump on. That was 80% of Trump voters. It was the economy, 19% for Democrats. The state of democracy, that was 80% for the Democrats, but 18% for Trump. And abortion, which we've talked about so often on the programme, I think this is interesting. 74% of Democrats voted for that. So it was, we'd say 25% for Trump, 74% Democrats, but it was just 14% of the electorate that was voting. So it's already quite a bit down. So let's see, we have economy, state of democracy, and then abortion. So with that breakdown, it just meant there weren't the numbers turning out for Harris that would have been expected.
A lot of data to get our head around, and no doubt the Harris team will be doing exactly the same in the coming weeks and months. We did hear from Kamala Harris speaking yesterday at Howard University. Let's take a listen to some of that speech.
So let me say, my heart is full today. My heart is full today, full of gratitude for the trust you have placed in me, full of love for our country, and full of resolve. The outcome of this election is not what we wanted, not what we fought for, not what we voted for, but we must accept the results of this election. Earlier today, I spoke with President-elect Trump and congratulated him on his victory. I also told him that we will help him and his team with their transition, and that we will engage in a peaceful transfer of power.
Vice President Kamala Harris there. Nuala, what were the key takeaways from that speech, in your opinion?
I think, you know, immediately, she didn't speak on the night. I think that's probably the first thing to underline. And lots of people kind of questioned that. One of her surrogates, Cedric Richmond, came out and said she would speak tomorrow. And then the people who had gathered to see her and support her then made their way out, some of them visibly distressed by it. That really, I think, continued as well. People would have seen it on social media, I'm sure, off really depending on who you voted for, how you reacted to that win. So eventually it came out that she would speak, and people did gather not far from here, about less than 2 miles from here is Howard University, and they went to meet her. I think she was putting forward that message of don't despair.
Yes.
Whether people take it on board or not, I'm not sure. I think a lot of people were very upset still. To me, I started thinking about 2016. I very much remember when Hillary Clinton came out and she talked about the glass ceiling and about trying to smash it through. And she spoke to little girls in particular. But that was 8 years ago now. So I was just thinking how much has moved on in that way when it comes to a woman president or being the commander in chief. I think with Kamala Harris, a lot of people, what they're saying was against her was, number one, the economy, and number two, the fact that she was following on from Biden, who was an unpopular incumbent, and that it was almost impossible for her to make the leaps and bounds that she would need to make to take on Mr. Trump. Kind of interesting as well to think about Donald Trump, that the two people he has run against, really, when it came to voting day, were women.
Yes, interesting. And the wider outcome that Team Harris will be grappling with, I imagine, is not just losing the Electoral College, but the popular vote as well.
Yeah, you know, I was in a coffee shop yesterday, and where I am in DC, I mean, this would be very much a blue area, a Democrat area. And I could hear two people in front of me. It's like, but he won the popular vote. And I think for Democrats, they're finding that quite difficult for some. But we had a fabulous number cruncher, Laksha Jain, from Split Ticket with us throughout election night. And I bumped into him yesterday and I was, you know, speaking to him about how did women vote, etc. And he says, some people are extrapolating, oh, you know, a lot of Latino men went for Trump, or much more black men went for Trump than previously. He's like, across the board, more people went for Trump. You know, he does have this mandate with the numbers that turned out. We can go through some of these demographics like we have, but on the whole, across America, popular vote and electoral college, he won.
Thanks, Nuala. And do stay with us, because we are going to turn our attention now to what a second Donald Trump presidency might look like and how it might look and feel for women as well. I'm joined now by the US Deputy Editor for The Telegraph, Rosina Sabour, and Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri, Director of the US and Americas Programme at Chatham House. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Now, we are going to unpick Donald Trump's policies in our conversation. But one thing I do want to put to you first is the language that we've been hearing from Donald Trump in recent weeks, especially about protecting women. Take a listen to this.
My people told me about 4 weeks ago, I was saying, no, I want to protect the people. I want to protect the women of our country. I want to protect the women. Sir, please don't say that. Why? They said, we think it's very inappropriate for you to say. I said, why? I'm president. I want to protect the women of our country. They said. They said, sir, I just think it's inappropriate for you to say. Pay these guys a lot of money. Can you believe it? I said, well, I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not.
Rosina, what do you make of that?
Well, classic Donald Trump there, expressing his frustration with his campaign advisors in public. Not the first time we've heard that from Donald Trump in the last few weeks, where he's bemoaned the fact that he's got to have some message discipline. He also complained recently about the fact that he couldn't call women beautiful anymore. And actually, the key architect of his winning campaign this time around is a woman, Susie Wiles. And he called her out by name and said, oh, you know, Susan Wiles, you wouldn't want me saying this. But yeah, a rather crude attempt to appeal to women in what we did expect to be historically a race really won or lost on gender. As Nuala's pointed out, those exit polls didn't bear that out, but that was what we were expecting from this race.
Yeah. And Leslie, the language there, lots of people talk about it almost sounding controlling to some.
I mean, clearly, there are many people across the United States that have voted for Donald Trump for a multitude of reasons. And I don't actually think that the language was either a motivator of very many votes or nor did it depress very many votes. I think Donald Trump in U.S. politics has become normalized. People have heard a lot from him over very many years and again on this campaign trail. And a lot of people, quite frankly, tune him out. And make their decisions about who they ultimately think. You know, we separate that basket of issues, the economy, rising prices, immigration, women's rights. You know, we know the top core issues. But when people go to the polls, they're not kind of going, I'm voting on the economy or I'm voting on women's rights. Some of them do. But most voters are sort of looking at the basket and they're looking at the leader. And sure, they might, you know, rank these things for a pollster, but there is a lot that goes into voting. And I think people were willing to disregard the rhetoric and make a decision. Who do they think is going to be the leader that represents them? Who do they think is going to be better for the country? Who, you know, suits their community? There's a massive rural urban divide in America. Joe Biden was the exception, right? He turned out rural voters for the Democrats. And what we've seen is that, you know, that's been erased. The rural voters that turned out for the Democrats have gone right back to the Republicans, to Donald Trump. So there's, you know, there are a lot of ways in which Americans have sorted themselves geographically, culturally. But, you know, overriding in this election, a very strong majority of Americans did not feel like the country is going in the right direction.
And we know that the economy played a huge part in that as well. Yeah. Well, let's unpick.
You know, one more thing, and I think it's really important to note, it was a landslide election by American standards. He's won the popular vote. He's done extremely well in the electoral college. He's won the swing states. But more than 68 million Americans voted for Kamala Harris. This is a woman, a Black Asian woman, who has a very powerful presence in the United States. And one of the most very interesting things to watch will be, what does she do with that voice? When you have 92% of Black women voting for you, what do you do with that voice in American politics and American society next?
I do want to try and unpick some of those key policies that Donald Trump is proposing, if we have the clarity on them. Rosina, let me turn to you and talk about the economy specifically, because the exit polls, the data that we have at the moment does say that the economy was one of the most important factors for voters. That is where we will start. Let me put this to you. The US Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that in 2023, women were nearly 70% of all minimum wage workers. It shocked me to learn that the current minimum wage sits at just over $7 an hour, and that hasn't changed since 2009. We're hearing from Donald Trump about lower taxes, higher tariffs on imports. But practically speaking, Rosina, what does this mean for women, especially those in difficult economic situations?
Yeah, the economy, obviously a critical issue for every voter in this election. The minimum wage issue in particular is a difficult one, because obviously, you know, 50 states, the economies of West Virginia and California are vastly different. Having a federal national minimum wage is a difficult thing to enact. And actually, Kamala Harris was the one that put forward a proposal to raise the minimum wage to $15 per hour. She made that promise quite late in the campaign, actually. It was only in the last fortnight or so that she announced that policy. But Donald Trump has made his own outreach to working class voters and, you know, service industry workers in particular. He vowed to end taxes on tipped wages, which is a big outreach to women in particular who work in the service industry. You know, that's not just in restaurants, that's salons, that's nail bars, the rest of it. So this was something that the Trump campaign was very aware of.
Yeah. The other key issue, of course, was abortion, one that we thought was going to be quite pivotal, or at least the analysts around the world certainly thought that way. Leslie, it certainly turned out to be less central, less pivotal than voters previously thought. What do we understand about what abortion laws might look like under a Trump presidency?
Well, you know, first of all, we know it's been devolved to the states, right? States now make decisions about abortion rights. And there is this question of whether or not there would be a national federal ban on abortion, or, you know, in Harris's case, one protecting. Donald Trump, in the lead up to the campaign, recognized that he was, you know, losing some ground on reproductive rights, his failure to really embrace them on the abortion rights issue. And he said, you know, he started saying things like, I'm going to support IVF, you know, fertility treatments for women. I'm not going to have a national ban on abortion. I think there's a level at which Americans, obviously not all Americans, but many Americans have moved on. They recognize that abortion is a fundamental issue, but they recognize that it's been shifted to the state level. And so we saw lots of proposals for amendments to state level constitutions. Nebraska had two amendments on the ballot. One was, you know, supporting abortion rights, and one was rejecting it, but every person in the state of Nebraska voted on. So, you know, it is a very significant issue, but it has been devolved. And I think that people have, you know, grappled with how to contest and manage that issue separate from the presidency. Clearly, a majority of Americans we're not, you know, singularly voting on that issue, which isn't to say that a lot of women were not.
Interesting take there. Rosina, I want to turn to childcare now with you. The average US couple spends 30% of their income on childcare. What might Donald Trump do about affordable, high quality childcare, in your opinion, especially for working families, but importantly for mothers?
Well, the biggest thing is child tax credits. It was actually Donald Trump who doubled the amount of the child tax credit during his first administration. One of his biggest legislative achievements was the 2017 tax cuts that he enacted. His campaign has declined to provide specifics on his plans for increasing the child tax credits, except to say that he would do so significantly. His running mate, J.D. Vance, now the vice president-elect, has also raised the possibility of increasing the child tax credit to about $5,000, so that more parents can stay home with their children, was his way of putting it. So unclear in terms of exactly, you know, the monetary amount, but that would be a key area where Trump has promised to help families.
Mm. Leslie, when it comes to immigration, Donald Trump is expected to mobilise agencies across US governments to help him deport record numbers of immigrants. Do we have an understanding of what kind of an impact this might have on women?
A very negative one. It's almost inevitable, sort of across the board, when it comes to this kind of dramatic policy, war, peace, immigration, deportations, women always suffer disproportionately. Whether it's because they are, you know, deported, whether it's because their families are separated, whether it's because they lose a source of income, but it tends to fall very harshly on women, but you know, men are going to suffer very significantly. But the one thing about deportations and that phenomenal promise by Donald Trump, which is a threat to so many people, is A, it's extremely hard to do. This is not going to be an easy policy to actually enforce. And B, you know, he's got plenty of corporate leaders in his camp. They need workers. Immigrants in America provide a very important source of income. And when you remove them, you create jobs that actually many Americans don't want to fill. And that creates pressure on wages. You want to attract workers, you increase wages, that creates inflationary pressures. And Donald Trump is going to have to kind of grapple with the economic reality that America's economy depends on the productivity of a tremendous set of immigrants. We also have, you know, an identity as an immigrant nation. So he's managed to politicize it. There is a real problem that's recognized across Democrats and Republicans that there's a problem at the border. But if we return, so there needs to be a policy, but if we return to the nastiness, if we stay in that toxic rhetoric, if we see, God forbid, family separation, like we saw during the first Trump administration, this will have a devastating impact on families, on women, on the economic health of immigration, and on America's border nation, which is to say Mexico.
Thank you for your thoughts there. Let me also bring back in Nuala McGovern. Nuala, the conversations you're having there, what do they say about the prospect of the United States ever electing a woman president?
Yeah, the question is being asked. I mean, I think a lot of people, coming back to the economy and some of the aspects that were being raised there in the conversation, it seems like it would have been the wrong time for Kamala Harris or any other woman to run, basically, that they were starting at well below where they should have been to try and run that race. Also, she only had 107 days, if we remember, the shortest, I don't know, historically, is it the shortest presidential campaign? It's definitely the shortest in modern history. There is one thing I'd like to mention, though, which, because there was also congressional races taking place for the House and the Senate. And in Delaware and Maryland, they both elected black women to the Senate. And this will be the first time in the US Senate in which two black women will simultaneously serve together, which is shocking in one way, but positive news in another. I don't know. I mean, I think after Hillary Clinton, they were saying, you know, trying to push younger women to get into politics. And we were hearing, you know, there was no pussy hat march, for example, like there was after Donald Trump's inauguration. But there was 2 years, or I suppose maybe 2 years after Hillary Clinton lost, this huge influx of women that entered politics into Congress, you know, whether it was in the House or the Senate. And you need women in those positions to then run for the White House. So will this, I don't know, inject or be a catalyst for more women making their way into politics? I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see, I guess.
Yes.
Maybe it was the wrong time this time.
Thank you so much, Nuala, there for us in Washington. And my thanks also to Rosina Sabour from The Telegraph and Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri from Chatham House. That conversation will continue for many days, weeks and months to come. Thank you also to you, our listeners, for sending in so many of your messages on red flag questions that you ask on dates or that you have been asked on dates. I will get to them shortly as well. But first, let us turn to football. We now know that more girls play football than netball. That's according to new analysis from Sport England. However, it can be a challenge to keep women and girls in the sport as they get older, with a range of barriers getting in the way. And this is the concern of my next guest, the footballer Iqra Ismail. You may have seen last week that Iqra, who captained Somalia's international team in 2019 and has worked as a coach, was barred from playing in a match for refusing to wear shorts due to her religious beliefs. The FA has since apologised. Iqra joins me now in the studio to tell me why she decided to speak out. Welcome, Iqra.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us what happened last weekend.
It was difficult. I think it was a difficult moment for me. I've been playing football since I was about 8 years old, and I think this is the first time really that I was told in no uncertain terms that I wouldn't be able to play because of my religious beliefs. Yeah, so I tried to step onto the pitch wearing tracksuit bottoms, as I have been doing in this same league for the last almost five years. And to my surprise, I was told by the referee that if I do not wear shorts, I will not be able to play. And obviously, I told him that it was because of my religious beliefs, and he said that I still wouldn't be able to play, even taking that into consideration. So, yeah, it was really difficult for me. It was really alienating, but, you know, the response since has been really positive.
Yeah. I mean, you've touched on it there, but expand on how that made you feel.
It was difficult. I think, you know, I've always been known to be stubborn in the best of ways. And I think, you know, I really don't want things like that to be able to put me off the game that I love. But, you know, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say that it really did feel like such an isolating moment for me. And I felt like, you know, the game can be so unforgiving sometimes. And it felt like one of those moments where, you know, you're being pushed away rather than being brought closer.
You decided to draw attention to this by posting a video on social media. Why was it important for you to speak out?
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I've always done my best to try and be the voice for, you know, women who look like me that want to play football. And for me, I had to be honest and I had to be genuine with myself, and I had to share that experience firstly to, you know, allow other people to resonate with me and allow them to, you know, resonate with that experience if people have faced a similar thing, but also to shed light on the issues faced by Muslim women in football and, you know, make people understand that as many steps as we've taken forward in the game and to make it more inclusive, this really did feel like a big step back.
Are you concerned about the impact this could have on young Muslim women wanting to get into the sport?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Muslim Sports Association recently did a study, and I think it said something along the lines of 45% of Muslim women don't play football because they feel like it's not a safe space for them and it's not something that's inclusive, and, you know, there aren't the correct venues or the correct, you know, sort of adaptations to clothing, as we've seen in this situation, for them to be able to feel comfortable to play. So it did really, really feel like a situation where it's being made a little bit more difficult for us. But saying that, conversely, the response from the Middlesex County FA and the FA has been really positive. They have been really apologetic and have wanted to work with me side by side to ensure that something like this never happens again.
Let me put to you what the FA has said. As I said, that they have apologised, and you pointed the same out there as well. We proactively wrote to all county FAs and match officials across the women's grassroots game earlier this year to confirm that women and girls should be allowed to wear clothing that ensures their faith or religious beliefs are not compromised. We remain deeply committed to ensuring that English football is an inclusive and welcoming environment for everybody. Do you believe that message is trickling down?
I think the FA have done really well to send out as much guidance as they can. I mean, you know, football's massive in this country, and there's so many leagues and so many respective county FAs. And as much as they sent out their message, of course, there can be incidences like this one where, you know, the respective league has not taken in that information and has not, you know, applied it correctly. And yeah, the FA are doing their best to rectify that. And the Middlesex County FA themselves have reached out to me, and I've had been in conversation with their chief executive, who has, yeah, ensured me that she'd work alongside me to make sure this doesn't happen again. And also asked me, you know, on my advice on how to best get this information out so there isn't gaps in communication as there has been in this situation.
Michelle in Nottingham is listening at the moment. Hi, Michelle. She sent us this message and says, I fail to see how showing bare legs is an important part of playing football. What kind of a response have you had from fellow football players, people in your community, for example?
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. Everybody has really been so supportive of me and, you know, so supportive of my response and me speaking out in the situation. You know, of course, there are always one or two negative comments, but it has generally been very positive. I think there was even a Premier League player that reposted it, I think a player for Ipswich Town. And yeah, you know, organisations like Nudrim Sports have reached out, Kick It Out, you know, loads of people have been really supportive and have asked me to, yeah, I guess, feedback and ensure that something like this, of course, as I said, doesn't happen again.
I'll also bring you this statement from the Greater London Women's Football League, who issued a statement saying it has been working with the FA to better understand the detail of the guidance regarding what women and girls can wear when playing football, which ensures their faith or religious beliefs are not compromised, something that you are working with various grassroots organisations to achieve as well. I want to learn more about your footballing journey. How did you get into it?
I was the one on the pitch, I think, in primary school with the boys running around chasing the football. I probably still am doing the same thing, I guess, to this point. You know, I always had that passion for the game. My brother's a big Chelsea fan, as am I. So that's how I got into, you know, my passion and watching the game and, yeah, once I felt a ball at my feet, I feel like I didn't really want to feel anything else. So now, obviously, I do play football and I also work in football for QPR Community Trust.
Yeah, and you are very competitive, as I understand it.
I try my best, yeah.
How have you remained determined to play? What's kept you going?
Honestly, the people around me, my support system, and, you know, also the women that I coach. So my work at QPR Community Trust, I am the Female Refugee Football Project Coordinator, meaning that I run football sessions for women of refugee and asylum seeking backgrounds, whether that be people that, you know, have come into the country 10 years ago or last week. So, you know, working with the women that I do, it's been really, really motivating and really inspiring to, yeah, see their journeys and see how much they enjoy the game. And yeah, I take inspiration from them.
Yeah. Tell us about the Never Underestimate Resilience Women's Football Club. Great.
Yes. Funnily enough, I sat in this chair 5 years ago, you know, wearing my tracksuit. So I started a football club originally called Nor Women's Football Club, and then it became Hilltop. And that was a club that was aimed at, you know, getting women like me from underrepresented groups more involved in football. The team does still run now, even though I've stepped away from it. But yeah, that journey was really beautiful for me. And it's really great now to come back to Women's Hour 5 years later and, you know,
and see how it's grown.
Of
right?
course. Yeah. Yeah.
And do you hope that more Muslim women can find a space in football? And what's out there for them to attain that, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the FA's motto is football for all. And I really do want to see that, you know, come into fruition in today's game. I think this is the kind of game that can be adapted for everybody. I feel like there is spaces for everybody to take part, whether that be sessions like my own and, you know, projects run through QPR and things like that, or just booking a pitch at the local goals or Power League and having a five-a-side session with your mates. And genuinely, from first-hand experience, I am seeing a lot more of it. I do feel like a lot of us grew up feeling like we were the only ones that were playing. You know, I was the only girl with a hijab on and a football under my arm, but it does genuinely feel so much different now, and it's lovely to say that.
Have you been able to get back onto the pitch wearing your tracksuit bottoms?
I have. So yeah, as of this past Sunday, I did get back onto the pitch. I did play. Both my team are really supportive, and, you know, even the opposition were passing on their respects and, yeah, being really supportive of the journey that I'd went through. So yeah, didn't win the game, but I did play.
Well, Iqra, thank you so much for joining us here on Women's Hour, sharing your experience. And yeah, we wish you all the very best with the next steps. Thank Perfect. You.
Thank you for having
Iqra
me.
Iqra Ismail there. Right, let's talk about red flags, because so many of you want to do exactly that. Thank you for all the messages that you have been sending in. Because here's the question. Do you have a first date red flag question? What would be an absolute surefire, definite no-no answer? And which answer would you receive that would mean there's going to be no second date? I'm asking this because Olivia Rodrigo, the American singer, songwriter and actor, is quoted as saying that if her date wants to go to space, that's a question she would ask. That is a red flag for her. So we wanted to know, do you have a red flag question? Do you ever use it? Was it effective? Or if you don't have one, what would it be? Joining me now is Helen Coffey, senior journalist at The Independent, who's written her take on questions that she would ask. And also on the line is Poppy J, director and podcaster, most famously on Brown Girls Do It Too, and now the spin-off Big Boy Energy. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
Helen, let me start with you. What did you think when you read Olivia Rodrigo's comment?
I mean, I think at first I was like, wow, what a niche question to ask. And is that really very fair to eliminate men based on that? And then I started thinking about it more and I was like, well, maybe not 20 years ago, but now kind of that desire to go to space is really associated with, let's face it, the sort of Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos types who have made it their mission. Like, I'm going to be the first to get commercial space travel going. And with the best will in the world, with the greatest respect, I really would not want to go out with someone who even vaguely resembled either one of those men. So I thought, actually, maybe it's a genius thing, like a very subtle question to slip in. Although now she's let the cat out of the bag. What she, people going to know they have to just lie and say, no,
avoid
no,
that question.
Space.
Yeah. Poppy, so what do you make of this? I mean, you're dating for fun at the moment. You're not settling down at the moment. But do you think Olivia Rodrigo's got a point about having that red flag question?
No, I love her niche question because it shows the calibre of men that she goes out with and the calibre of men that I go out with. I do. I am, even though I'm just dating and having fun and not necessarily looking for, well, definitely not looking for a relationship, there are a set number of questions that I ask guys on first dates that are like my universal flag, red flag questions. One is, do you have any female friends or close female friends? And if he doesn't, I'm like, I mean, I say get in the bin. I'll probably see them again if they're fun, but there's no future there, right? If he has no female friends, then to me, that says about a myriad of things. Number one, he sees women as female objects, or you know, women that he can only have sexual relations with, and not see a friendship. I also, being Asian, with Asian guys, will absolutely first in, just to scare them, will ask them what their relationship like is with their mother.
Yes.
Obviously, I'm being very sort of on the nose with you guys now. So, I mean, I do kind of, I'm much more subtle, believe it or not, but I do ask them what the relationship is like with their mother. If it's very, very problematic and too unhealthy, then they're going in the bin. I always ask what they don't like to eat. I don't like fussy eaters.
Okay.
So if they come up with a list of, oh, I don't like fish and I don't like this and I don't like that, in the back of my mind, I'm like, well, there's no second date here. And also, I always ask them, maybe this is a second date question because it's a bit too deep, but I ask them, a bit like Helen's article, when was the last time they opened up to a male friend and last time a male friend opened up to them? And I think also this is a red flag question reserved for first slash second dates. I like to get a makeup of their friends because if their friends are all from the same class and the same world, I have no interest. They have to have an interesting group of friends from all over. And if they just have a set group of friends and it's all lads and they all have the same kind of world experience and the same worldview, then I'm sort of much less
That's a
interested.
lot to sift through, Poppy, and we're going to break some
Well,
of
I get to a lot on first dates,
that
Cooper. I do a lot.
Well, look, Martha is one of our listeners, and she agrees with you about food. And she says, if they had broad and varied answers to me, it tells me a lot about who they are. Are they willing to try new things? Are they worldly? Are they open-minded? And she's talking specifically there about cheese, believe it or not. And this listener says, my red flag question is, what are your thoughts on OnlyFans? So again, Poppy, going back to what you were saying about the female body, it opens up a whole conversation on how they perceive women and their bodies. And asked after this, I asked this after 3 months and realized I was dating a misogynist. For context, I am pro-women, and they can do what they want. Thank you for your messages. Helen, your key questions that you must ask on a date.
Well, I mean, they were somewhat tongue in cheek, but also I think probably do stand up under scrutiny, because I just started thinking about not the big questions like, do you want kids? What is your religious view? What are your politics? You know, these things that we can all agree you might want fundamental agreement on. But especially these days, I think lots of men would identify as a feminist, perhaps, or would never say I'm a misogynist. And yet, the more you kind of delve underneath, the more you're like, you've got some problematic ideas there that you're not being upfront about. So, just quick ways to sift them out. My first one was, do they have any cryptocurrency? Now, that's a big
See,
difference.
this one
Like,
threw me. You've got to unpick that one for me. Tell me more.
there's this sort of a crypto guy thing going on, right? And it's again, it's very Elon Musk adjacent because he loves crypto. There's one thing: if he's got some Bitcoin that he bought, you know, 10 years ago, fine. That he's never really thought about again. Doesn't really know how to access it. But if you ask, and actually the next 15 minutes are spent talking about blockchain, that is possibly a crypto guy. And that is a lot of what he will want to talk about. It's just quite indicative about a certain type of personality, which I'm probably going to get loads of hate for saying it. But I have found the Venn diagram of that and being quite problematic in various ways can really overlap somewhat, probably because of the online spaces that they're taking up. I also would ask what the last book they read was. Not being a snob here, unless it's a really deeply problematic book that they were like, I'm such a big fan. Ooh. But it's mainly to ascertain, like, do they ever read? Because these days, a lot of men will literally say to you, oh, I haven't read a book since I was a kid. And this will be like a 45-year-old man. And I just find that absolutely like flabbergasting. I mean, audiobooks I'll accept, but if they just are like, no literature whatsoever for me. That's a red flag. That's just a personal one. Not everyone will have that one.
But
Also,
hobbies matter, right? Hobbies do matter, and having something
do you
in
know what?
common matters.
Yeah. And I think I didn't include this, but I think that's a great shout. I think a man that doesn't have any extracurricular activities that they're interested in at all, that's a big red flag. What, like, if all they do is work and go to the pub and they've got nothing else going on, not sure we're going to really get along in life. And who they choose to spend their time with. Poppy was so right in saying that. Really, you can tell a lot by a person's friends. And that's why one of mine was like, because they might not really tell you what their friends are like, but asking who their kind of celebrity kind of friend crush is, like if they could go for a drink with anyone for a fun night out who's famous, who would it be? can tell you a lot, because that will tell you who they think is sort of on their level. And if they're saying like Joe Rogan or something, I'm sorry, yeah. I'm out if that's your sort of dream friend.
Well, Helen Catherine agrees with you. She says, I like to ask new people, who would you love to go out to dinner with and talk to you about their life and views, alive or dead? So she agrees with you there. Here's one question I'd like to put to both of you. Maybe Poppy, you want to kick off. Look, dating can make people feel really nervous when you're sat in front of someone you hardly know, or sometimes you've never met. Sometimes you say really silly things, right? Second chances, where do you stand on that? If they give a dud answer the first time round, do you follow up, Poppy?
Yeah, I have a traffic light flag system. Red flags you can't come away from. Ambers, I'll give you a chance on an amber. And obviously green flags are great. Yeah, I think it's like, if you weigh it up, if they've got like one, you know, when you take a driving test, you've got majors and minors.
Yes.
They've got like one major and a couple of minors. You know, you're just like, I like you enough that I'm going to give you another chance. So you might throw them another question, like a lifeboat, and see if they latch on.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they don't, I mean, it depends on the red flag. Because if the red flag is very red flaggy, you're just, there's no saving from that, really. I don't know about Helen, but it's like, I don't know how much you can come back. But also, I have to turn the mirror back on me. I mean, I hope I'm not giving red flag energy, but there might be some things that I say that I'm, that guys are like, God, I'm not going to see her again. So I think sometimes you've got to approach these things with an open mind, but it really depends on your boundaries and it really depends on what you're into. Like, for instance, the cryptocurrency question. See, Helen, I wouldn't mind because I'm quite fascinated by all of that, probably because of my job as a director where I'm looking for stories and I'm like, what are these guys and these finance bros into? Certain things like the big stuff would be a complete turn off, you know, yeah. If they really thought Jacob Rees-Mogg was an absolute ledge, there would be some questions.
But look, it's not always about the serious stuff, right? Let me put this one to you. A listener writes, her red flag question would be, or his, can you pay for my chips? I don't want to break into a fiver. Helen, what do you make of that money talk on a first date? Is that a red flag?
Do you know, this is one of mine, and people will have really different opinions to me on this. But actually, a red flag for me would be in either direction, but because I'm a heterosexual woman, it normally happens a certain way around, which is a man will offer to pay. I absolutely refuse. I would say on nearly any kind of date, but especially a first date, I want to pay half. I feel very passionate about that. This is 2024. They're not paying for me because I'm like their property or because they necessarily earn more money than me. So if they, I don't mind someone offering, but if they are really insistent and they say, I am not going to let you pay, that for me is like, no, it's an absolute no. And the other way around, like if I was a guy and the woman expected me to pay and was very like, you're obviously covering this, that's a red flag in that direction as well for me. I'm sorry.
Yes. I should have actually finished reading that.
I completely agree.
Sorry, go ahead, Poppy. Yep.
Sorry, just to jump in.
Yeah.
I completely agree with Helen. Unless you're some billionaire and you insist on taking me out to a bar that's well beyond my means, then that's fine. But this idea, and on this podcast I host called Big Boy Energy, I have guys on and they're like, girls expect us to pay all the time. I'm like, who are these women? Because Helen and I don't. And a guy is like, no, I insist on paying. I'll pay. I'm like, I'm just as much. We can go halves on this. It's okay. I'm not going to think any less of you. But apparently there is a corner. Sorry, I'm getting ranty. There's a corner on the internet where they're like, these girls, they want us to be chivalrous and they want us to be masculine. And then they want us to pay half. I mean, I'm sure those women exist, but like, I'm not seeing those women. And those women are not my friends either.
And so, I should add that this listener who got in touch actually married this man. And so the nightmare began, she says. He plundered everything and everyone I brought into our world. After two breakdowns, I finally woke up, which is why those red flag questions are so important. I'm going to put this last one to you briefly, Poppy. A red flag question for this listener was, do you iron your jeans? If a yes comes out, that means the guy is too high maintenance for me. Your thoughts, Poppy?
Can he iron my jeans? And then that would make that red flag into a green flag. Yeah, I have to admit, like a guy who's ironing t-shirts and shoelaces and bed sheets, if he's got more product in his wash bag than I do, it's just, and I feel that's actually quite an unfeminist statement for me to make, because on the one hand, I'm like, I do want him to be quite clean, but yes, if he's ironing his jeans, nah.
Helen Coffey from The Independent and Poppy J from the podcast Brown Girls Do It Too and Big Boy Energy. Thank you so much. Absolute pleasure speaking to you and hearing your thoughts on red flag questions. Women's bodies have long been a major theme throughout art history, from Sandro Botticelli's The Birth of Venus to Mother and Child by Gustav Klimt. And that theme continues to run through my next guest's artwork. Sophie T is known for her nude paintings of women of all shapes and sizes, which have found fame across social media. And she joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Women's Hour, Sophie.
Thank you for having me.
Now, a lot of your work, as I've mentioned, captures the nude female form. Why is this so central to your work?
I think because I never had the best relationship with my own body growing up, honestly. Like, I have always hated my boobs, and I always thought, like, if I was, like, 14 years old and I, like, saw in the media, like, in a magazine or in a movie, like, someone with a flatter chest, then it would have just, like, made such a difference to how I felt about my body, like, when I was young. So I think it just really stems from that, like, just wanting, like, young people to know that they're enough.
How do you go from that insecurity to where you are now?
Well,
deciding to paint, create the female form in all artistic shapes and sizes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a decision you have to make, like, all the time, every day. Like, it's not just, like, one thing that you finally get and you're happy. You do need that reminder. And I get that with the women who are my muses, and I paint them. And, yeah, I mean, it's not an easy journey, but it requires actually a lot of hard work and maintenance and... Yeah, I just like to be able to be a person that can guide others on that journey, even though I'm not great at myself still.
When you first started out painting nudes, mm-hmm. you asked your followers to send nudes to you to use as reference images.
Yes.
What kind of a response did you get?
Wow. Well, I actually woke up to over 1,000.
Over 1,000. My goodness.
Yeah, it was wild. And you know what the best thing about it was? Like, all of the pictures came with a story of why they felt it was so important to share. I mean, I'd been painting probably for 5 years before that, and I was just honestly just blown away by how vulnerable these women were. Like, I mean, some of them were funny. This one girl was like, oh my god, Sophie, I've never sent my boyfriend a picture of myself, but here's one for you. And
love
then
that.
Yeah, it was amazing. And then I remember this one girl, she'd sent me like a link to a Dropbox, and there was 150 images of her, all different times and like angles. And I was just like, I still use those images now.
Well, I was going to say, what do you do with all this material, 1,000 images?
Yeah. But I do remember this one, and I always talk about this because I think it was like when I read it, I was just like, God, like, this lady, she sent me a picture. She'd had a double mastectomy. Mm-hmm. And she said that her mum had passed away from breast cancer 2 months before. And if her image could be a part of whatever was being made, that would mean the world to her. I don't know. It just, there's women everywhere going through a lot of stuff.
Exactly. And it sounds like you captured women's stories just through their photos from across the spectrum.
Yeah.
Celebrating, confused, complex.
Well, I think that when I was looking for reference images online, like they, like, you know, you type in naked women online, like pornographic stuff is going to come up, but not so much that. It was, I was seeing the same body type, and I wanted to like see bodies like mine or like my mum's or like my sister's, like, and it was just this same body. So I just, honestly, it was just great to see and have real women be so open to sharing, because they all know how important it is.
You took that project to the next level in Send Nudes, a live show earlier this year, where you painted live with around 50 naked women. Tell us about that.
It was crazy. It was at the Palladium. I have these applications. They're called nudie applications. We had 10,000 women apply to be.
So for 1,000, we're now on 10,000 for a live show.
It's for a live show.
Incredible numbers.
Yeah. And then I read through all the applications. It took actually me and my team like a couple of weeks. And what I do is I paint on their naked body, and the show's 90 minutes. So there's different elements to it. I do a live painting element with a choir, and there's an interview section with some of the women. But the crescendo, I guess, is at the end where all the women are naked and there's this huge catwalk, and they all walk down and the crowd is cheering and the energy in the room. It's just insane. Like, it's one of the best moments ever. And yeah, it's kind of it's become a thing. I think I've done 6 shows now over the past 5 years, and they keep growing each time. And
incredible. Yeah. Incredible. Let's talk about your journey. You came to art with no art degree, no contacts, little skill, you say. Here you are. You use social media to find success.
Yeah, I've always used social. I think, like, well, I never studied art. I studied business. And I came across being an artist really quite randomly. Like, I was always good at it at school. But, like, you know, when your teachers are like, yeah, like, but don't do it as a career type thing. Like, just, you know, it's good that you can paint, but don't pursue it. But I remember, you know, that, like, year or that, like, time before you get a proper job after you graduate. Well, I remember I went travelling to India, and I was running out of money, and there was this wall and it, a hostel, and it had loads of graffiti on it. So I just randomly asked the manager if I could, like, paint in return for a free stay. And he said, yeah. And that was the first time I painted again since I was at school. And I was like, oh my goodness, I actually need to do this with my life. And then all of a sudden I decided I was an artist. I'd emailed my grad scheme like, hiya, I've decided that I want to become a painter. They were like, yeah, we literally don't care, like, we've got someone else.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I've just used social the whole time. I think I did try the gallery route, honestly. I tried to pull together a portfolio, but, you know, galleries take 50% commission. Like, it's a huge whack. And I think I just recognized very early on that the art market needed democratizing, because normal people buy my work, not people that have studied art or know about it, or, like, you know, the impact of art is huge, and it can have such a positive impact to so many people. And that's what I'm trying to get to, really. You don't have to be a certain type of person with money to, like, enjoy it, you know.
What do you say to people who say, you might be pessimistic about the projects that you do, and say, this isn't an artist here, here we have an influencer?
Oh, interesting. I mean, I am actually coming into this question more and more because I'm blowing up on social right now, which is funny because, like, I've always used social as just the vehicle for me to connect with my audience, to be honest. And business-wise, like, all the sales come through my website and drive the Instagram. But I don't know, I feel, honestly, like, video creation as well is an art form. Like, it is one of the arts. So, and I think the definition of being an artist is connecting to an audience. So however you decide to do that, whether it's on stage, whether it's on video, whether it's painting, whether it's sculpting, like, you know, this is the problem, I think, with, like, the art world, like, trying to, like, put people in boxes or, like, make people define being an artist in a certain way. Like, it's actually how you connect with people, in my opinion.
Yeah. Another way that you've connected with people is through the Charity Shop Hunt series. So people who don't know much about that, tell us more.
Okay, so every Friday I go to a random charity shop in the UK. Actually, last week was Bali because I was away, and mm-hmm. that was fun. But I go in, find an object, buy it, take it away, paint on it, then take it back to the charity shop, redonate it, and then put it on my social media, on my Instagram stories, honestly, and just say, this is my location, come now. And week one person came, and it took like half an hour, and I was so embarrassed because, like, I was literally just there on my own. And now it's become this, like, cult thing. We're on week 18.
That's incredible.
And we've been all over the UK, and it's just so nice.
And tell me about the things that you've painted and recreated, reinvented.
Honestly, the most random things. I mean, I've done clogs. I did a wooden dog in Bali recently, bags, vases, a doll's house, a Monopoly board. Like, it's honestly all random stuff, and it's so funny because, you know when you, like, meet someone first time, you're like, yeah, I'm an artist, and then, like, all right, let's see your work, and you click up my Instagram now, and it's just like all these random things. I'm like, no, like, I am actually a proper investment grade artist. Just scroll down a bit.
Pots, pans, and nudes.
But yeah, no, it's been an absolute blessing. Yeah. Like, yeah,
and I believe your school art teacher came along, Miss Thomas.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, I went back to Chester a few weeks back, which was nice.
And community is a big element of your work, isn't it?
Oh, it's everything. Like, it's everything. Like,
yeah,
I'm very blessed to do what I do and meet the people that I do. And many of them have, you know, my nudies, that many of them are now my best friends. Like, yeah, it's just this whole world we've made. It's just this beautiful.
Special, yeah. Tell us about your new show, Muse, at the Outernet in London.
Okay, so it's in like 2 weeks' time. I've got a lot to do, but we're doing a catwalk. And the difference this time is there's a huge emphasis on tech. So I'm actually, I don't know whether you know what they are, but you know those like tilt brush things that you like put on the goggles and then you can like make like digital art like through a tilt brush. Anyway, basically, so I'm going to be live painting on stage and then embellishing it with like a digital element. And there's obviously all these massive, amazing screens at Alton at London.
Yes.
So yeah, that would be an interesting side to it. So,
and why are you doing this?
Why am I doing it?
I understand that there's a theme, mental health, that is really important.
Yeah, I feel like, honestly, just making women feel a bit nicer about themselves is very important. Like, whenever an audience or anyone interacts with what I'm doing, whether it's the artwork or we have a gallery on Carnaby Street, so whether it's they come in or whether it's they see a show, like, I just want to just have a like small, very tiny but positive impact when they walk out. So I guess that's it. I don't know where it comes from. God, you may be getting a bit deep there. I don't know why I want to do that, but yeah.
Well, look, you're doing some tremendous stuff. It's great to look at your feed and see what you get up to. Thank you so much, Sophie T there, the artist, on her work and the focus she places on depicting the female form. Thank you to you all for sending in your questions about first date questions. There's red flag questions. What is your relationship like with your most recent ex? That question is one that our listener would put, and she says that it should be civil if possible, but not too close. And this one from Rosemary says, a red flag for me is a man who doesn't ask me any questions about it at all. And my first take question from this one says, tell me about your kids. The answer I was looking for was something like, I love him, her, them. It's really sad that the mother and I aren't together, but we try to put the kids first. Thank you for all of your messages. Do keep them coming in on social media at BBC Women's Hour, where you can keep the conversation going. But for now, from myself, Krupa Bardi, and the rest of the Women's Hour team, thank you for your company.
Thanks for listening. There's plenty more from Women's Hour over at BBC Sounds.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Young, and I'm happy to tell you that Young Again, my podcast for BBC Radio 4, is back with more conversations with people who fascinate me. In the new series, we'll hear from the comedian Miranda Hart.
Part of being human is that we are vulnerable.
The writer Irvin Welsh.
It's quite a thing to be 8 years old and then suddenly to have a criminal record.
And we'll begin with a conversation with the actor Minnie Driver.
What do you wish you'd understood about the movie business?
It's all ephemera. None of it is real.
Subscribe to Young Again on BBC Sounds.